Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, over in Durham, a DEA's race is still smarting. And, of course, there's the upcoming trial that still splits the Durham community. There's lots more news about Chapel Hill and Durham. And so how does the editor of the local paper make a decision about what to put on the front page? And in order to answer that question and many others, I've asked Bob Ashley, who's generously agreed to come back to visit us. Bob is the editor of the Durham Herald-Sun. So, Bob, what about this DA's race? Are you still sizing it up on your political pages?
Well, it's to some extent, yes. I mean, the it's died down some now with the election over, but of course, and let me say, by the way, that it's I'm always glad to be back here with you. It's a great opportunity for me, and I appreciate it. The DA's race is over, but some of the events that gave it the event that gave it energy is still going on with the continuing presumably now run up to a trial on the Duke LaCrosse rape case, and it's never very far away from the surface of the news over there.
How do you, not as an outsider, mm-hmm. but as someone who's been away from Durham and can put a perspective mm-hmm. that could be more balanced and objective than those of us who've been here. How does this series of events reflect what the Durham community, the patchwork or the blending that is the Durham community, excuse me for preaching while I ask this question. I mean, this is not right. But I mean, you think of it, you know, in one sense, Durham is this wonderful multicultural thing with a great university, mm-hmm. a great dynamic black population, and a whole series of wonderful, innovative businesses that are a part of it. And the other is it's full of violence, and it's fractured between the university or among the university, the black population, a working class white population. How do you see it? That's the end of the question.
Right, exactly, right. Well, gosh, is that all? Can I do this in 2 minutes or less?
We need to take a break before you answer.
Right. Now, as is true of many things, a lot of the caricatures of Durham that surround this case contain both an element of truth and are at the same time overdrawn. And you mentioned, I think part of the walk up to this was talking about this sort of the tension between NC Central University, a really fine historically black university, and Duke, of course, which has a national reputation as one of the top universities in the country, and historically, more so than now, was universally white, and now is not nearly as white as it used to be. And in fact, I think if you take sort of all minorities into account, has a substantial minority student enrollment. But you talk about that fissure. I was at North Carolina Central this morning talking with James Ammons, the chancellor, and he was talking, as the folks at Duke have, talked to me about the efforts, particularly last spring, for the two universities to basically use this case as an opportunity to remind them how important it was to pick common cause. And first of all, as Chancellor Ammons reminded me this morning, and I know there is all kinds of collaboration between faculty members, all kinds of interaction between the administrations, maybe not so much among the student body. And at Central and at Duke, the student government leaders have really pledged themselves and I think have worked hard in both last spring and certainly this fall to try to bridge that gap, which does exist, between the two. And I think the relations between the two universities are quite good and at the student body level, based on what I know, reasonably solid this year. There's still, we're never going to have a situation. They're not next to each other. They're separated by, several miles, not to mention some cultural divides. But I think that there is not a sense that the two schools, the student body or the administration, are warily circling each other, waiting to land the body blow in this case. The issue of sort of the fissure in Duke along racial lines, certainly it's there. It's a city that is more so than most major American cities, relatively equally balanced between its white populations, black populations. One of the things that makes Durham somewhat unusual, if not unique. And at many, many levels, those relations work day in and day out constructively. There's a lot of interaction. Part of it, of course, is the historic existence of a black entrepreneurial and middle and upper middle class in Durham. That works together, and their points are fissure. Some of them have nothing to do with the lacrosse case. They have to do with schools sometimes. They have to do with power.
Power. Is there any analogy between Durham and Baghdad in the sense that you have two really strong, committed groups? Right. If it weren't for the color, right, you wouldn't know. You couldn't tell these people apart, right, because they've got, we can't tell Shia, right, and Sunni Muslims apart, but the differences. And if everybody's right, kind of on the same page, you can put all religion and everything aside. But and in Durham, if you put race right aside, you can do all kinds of things. But when it comes right down to it, everybody's got to ask the question, have we got our fair share of power? And does that get in the way of a real constructive approach to things?
Oh, I suppose it gets in the way occasionally.
You don't accept the analogy.
I don't accept the analogy. We haven't had a lot of car bombings. We've had occasional bus shootings, but we haven't had a lot of car bombings. In fact, we've had no car bombings that I know of in Durham, lest I give the impression that we've had some. None that I'm aware of. Power is sometimes an issue. You've got a very strong political action, historically strong political action group in the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People. You have some strong business-oriented political action group in the Friends of Durham, and a strong, more liberally oriented group in People's Alliance. All of them, looking for some political power. But one of the things that happens in Durham that I think sometimes is misunderstood by people who don't live there or don't spend time there is that there is a robust dialogue that's always going on in Durham. And it goes on at many levels, from the neighborhood level and very active neighborhood groups there, right up to the city councils, county commission chambers, political groups. And a lot of that discussion is sometimes heated but usually healthy. I mean, we tend not to hide our differences in Durham. We tend to put them out on the table and kick them around and occasionally kick each other around while we're doing it. And the latter is sometimes a problem. But it's I don't know that there's any more jousting for or struggle, if you will, for power in Durham than any other place I've been. It does sometimes break along racial lines, mm-hmm, but it often doesn't. And, right now, one of the staunchest critics from time to time of the mayor and the administration in Durham, and both of them are African, both the mayor and the city manager are African American, is an African American city councilman, Thomas Stith, a somewhat more conservative leaning councilman, very articulate, very thoughtful, very smart, and lately very critical of some things that are happening. Thomas would like to be mayor, we think. He's not an avowed candidate for mayor, but the widespread belief is that Thomas will run against Bell. So you may have two African Americans, different political ideologies, competing for power. Right now, the board chair of the school system is African American. The assistant, the vice chair, is white. And probably the relationships on the school board are as amicable as they've been ever, and certainly more amicable they were in the first year and a half I was there. So the lines are diffuse in Durham. Yes, oftentimes there's a racial component to it. Oftentimes there isn't. Part of it is historical. I mean, you still have a situation where for most people, certainly our age, even 10 years younger, white or black, the memory of a time when the power was incontrovertibly held only by white folks and mostly by white guys is still a recent memory. And there's no question that that heritage still colors, probably a poor choice of words, but still influences people's view of the power dynamic in Durham and lots of other cities, but again in Durham with the relatively equal divide. And of course, we haven't even talked about the impending issue of where Hispanic quest for a share of this power is going to come in. At this point, the Hispanic community is not particularly politically active, but I suspect that over time that's going to change.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Hispanic community is like many immigrant communities, mm-hmm, focused on putting bread on the table for
right
tomorrow, and the politics of it are strange, but that changes as various political groups try to, mm-hmm, enlist allies. Yeah, that'll be fun to watch. And are you sensing mm-hmm a big influx of Hispanic permanent residents
Well, I think I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's certainly one across the state. This is one of the fastest growing Hispanic communities in the country, and we're certainly seeing our share of it in Durham. I think if I remember correctly, it's somewhere around 10 or 11% right now in the last census count, and they widely believe that that's the number is undercounted. Whether percentage changes much or not, I'm not sure.
Well,
but it's growing, and it's evident. It's visible in lots of ways. It's visible in the number of taquerias around town, and it's visible in the workforce in some areas.
I'm talking to Bob Ashley, who is the editor of the Durham Herald Sun. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Bob Ashley, the friend of mine and who happens to be the editor of the Durham Herald Sun, has agreed to come over and do missionary work here in Chapel Hill. I mean, he's doing it permanent, full-time. On behalf of the – would you assert that the people in Durham should be out with missionary zeal selling their diverse way of living to this kind of elitist group of people who live in Chapel Hill and think they're so much better than everyone else?
I think, as you well know, as we all know, the interaction between the communities is really quite strong.
But you're not sending, they're not going to send troops over and no regime change.
One of the things that I believed when I came here, and I've only come to believe even more, is that Durham is a richer city for having Chapel Hill 12 miles away, and Chapel Hill is a richer city for having Durham 12 miles away. They're two quite different. Certainly the surface difference between them is great. There's a cultural difference between the two of them. One of them is home to a great private university and a fine historically black public university, and the other is home to one of the outstanding public universities in the country. What a rich juxtaposition!
Yeah,
as everybody who lives here knows. But I think.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Just to get, are these places, Chapel Hill and Durham, as you report and observe them, are they safe places to live relative to other parts of the United States?
Oh, I think absolutely. Now, does that mean that there's some places that I would be hesitant to go, anybody would hesitant to go at midnight in Durham, or for that matter, midnight in Chapel Hill? I was just listening to someone at lunch, as were you, DG, who's lived here for a long time, and a thoughtful person, a faculty member at UNC, who says that she doesn't like to go downtown to Franklin Street after dark. That stunned me a bit. Because if you live in Durham, you expect people at Chapel Hill to say that about Durham, but not about Chapel Hill. Now, I think that's an exaggerated fear, but it's a real fear. Just as I think it's an exaggerated fear that some people have about about being in Durham after dark. Do you have to be cautious? Yes, it's an urban environment. Do you have to be careful, even in Chapel Hill? Yes, but I think I don't have much compunction about going almost any place in either city, and I don't think lots of other people do.
Well, speaking of violence, who are you pulling for in the Battle of the Titans, football-wise, upcoming Duke Carolina football game?
Well, that's an interesting question.
Do you wear front of your coat is dark blue, navy Duke blue, and the other side is light blue. Yeah. How do you do that?
There is no question that I have some emotional tie to my alma mater, which is Duke. So we'll just sort of say that and put that out on the table. Professionally, I'm an agnostic. If Duke wins ball games, we do well. If Carolina wins ball games, we do well.
So this has not been the best season for you, has
Well,
it?
But as my friends at NC Central are reminding me this morning, if NC Central wins ball games, we do well. And it's funny, they were grousing, I think, correctly about some of the – I don't think they were talking about our coverage, but some of the TV coverage where there's been a lament this year about what a terrible season it's been. Nobody's been winning in triangle football. And they say, wait a minute. Quite correctly, they've not only been winning, but I believe that their victory total of victories right now is roughly almost triple the total victories by the other three universities, Duke, Carolina, and NC State.
No, it really is amazing. You, Chapel Hill people, won't let you get away with it because we said, well, of course the coach lives in Chapel Hill, and he was a Chapel Hill coach.
Of course, there you go.
But there is, I mean, it's interesting. Right. Would you ever get a real ownership feeling among white people for North Carolina Central Athletics?
Probably not, quite frankly. I mean, I think that there's some shared joy, even given the racial dynamic about that. I mean, you know, Durham folks like winners, and Chapel Hill folks like winners. We all like winners, and I think that there's some genuine excitement throughout the community. But it does NC Central have the following, you know, maybe across the Durham Chapel Hill span? That in the white community that Duke or Carolina does, probably not. Yeah.
Well, it's funny. You know, we all like to pretend we're not racist, and we have put race behind us and everything. But I have to confess on some racial pride, when the guy who kicked this long field goal to make North Carolina Central the winner in this game a couple of weekends ago was a white guy.
Yep.
You know, and so it's funny. When I was more closely involved with Central and used to go to their games, they used to kid me. They had a white kicker too. And so whenever he would come, they'd say, DG, here's your man. But there is a rich potential that, to a certain extent, we have benefited by. And in another sense, there's an enormous unrealized potential that we have in front of us to work on that can make things even richer and better. At least that's my
point of view. I think that's exactly right.
My point of view. What about college athletics? You know, newspaper editors tend to agree with William Friday and the Knight Commission that we've gotten swept away by athletics. Does Mike Krzyzewski, is he more important to the Duke community than the president of Duke?
Well, he probably draws a bigger crowd than the president, and that's not unique to Duke. I used to joke, and it's actually sort of true here too, that when I was in State College, Pennsylvania for 7 years, I frequently met with the president of Penn State University, but I never once met Joe Paterno, the football coach, because he was on way too elevated a level for me to have any interaction with. I'm glad you invoked Bill Friday, because I would have if you hadn't, to give myself some cover. Like many newspaper editors, as you point out, I worry about the, and many others I might add, about the extraordinary sort of disproportionate expenditure on attention to and just sort of cultural infestation by big-time college athletics. At the same time, I was high-fiving on the floor when Sean Dockery beat Virginia Tech with a last-second shot last season. We get excited to the newspaper and put out special sections when one of our teams wins a national championship. We're going to be excited about NC Central's. I'm confident that they'll make it all the way to a national championship in football. So we celebrate and profit from it ourselves. And so where does that leave me? I tell people sometimes the front page and the sports page reflect life as it is, and the editorial page is life as we wish it would be. And there's some of that that goes on here. We have to reflect reality, even while we might have some doubts about it. And certainly here in the Triangle, we're front and center, looking in the face, the question of how big is too big in college athletics. As I've said before, and most people would agree, I think, Duke and Carolina, as the two Division I schools here, let's leave NC Central aside for a moment, have probably done a better job than most of squaring the circle of balancing great academic standards, great academic and research success, great intellectual firepower with outstanding athletic programs. Well, maybe not outstanding football programs this season, but outstanding athletic programs overall, and certainly in basketball, some of the highest profile in the country. It can be done. But I think there are thoughtful people on the Duke campus and on the UNC campus who say, maybe not so much. Maybe we think it's being done. But if you look at the SAT scores of athletes versus others, you raise some questions about whether or not there is some compromise there in the academic standards to do it. And you wonder, are we so focused on that it takes our attention away as institutions as citizens from things that are ultimately more important than, you know, frankly, who wins the Duke Carolina football game 10 days from now.
Yeah, well,
the good news is one of them will win, and therefore for the Triangle, things will look a little bit better than they have on most Saturdays.
Yeah, I guess that's right, that there'll be a winner in a. What are you going to call the name of the bowl that it would be? But the it raises the question. I guess the Herald Sun on that day doesn't have is happy that there will be a winner among readers of the Herald Sun. But have you thought about, and could you share with us your thinking, even if you haven't come up with a final answer? But what are the events like, big sports events, or elections, decisive events, wars? What kind of events these days in today's market would sell newspaper? Would be the occasion for an extra edition, or would be, or for a big print to sell on the streets?
Well, you know, and this gets back to something we were talking about just a moment ago. Frankly, you know, national basketball champions are in that. Frankly, diminishing, I think, number of things that really drive extra newspaper sales in a way that even 10 years ago, more things might have done that. For a while, I did a presentation sometimes for circulation directors, because as an editor, one of my big interests has been trying to make sure that circulation departments and news departments actually talk to each other instead of existing in different worlds. And I actually stole this from a colleague of mine. I'd flash a picture. I'd say that what I've learned in my career is that news sells newspapers, and I'd flash on the screen a picture of Elvis Presley. Because when Elvis Presley died, it drove one of the, at that point, the highest single sales days of newspapers in the history of the Charlotte Observer, which is where I was at the time that happened. Events like that used to sell newspapers more than I bet they would today. I bet if Elvis died today, we wouldn't see nearly the, well, if he died today,
well,
it would
be
a heck
today,
of a story, right, exactly. But if that were to happen today, I don't think it would be quite the same. Because the internet, because the saturation of TV news, both have given people sort of a more immediate sense of events. They looked to us and looked to print media, I think, more for sort of a recapitulation, a historical affirmation of it. But I don't think it does it in quite the way that it used to. But to answer your question about what does, no, we saw some uptick in sales during some of the most fervent or torrid days of the early stages of the lacrosse scandal, rape case scandal, whatever you want to call it. Every word I choose to describe is attacked by somebody.
Yeah,
so I sometimes use several just to string them together.
So you can get attacked from all sides.
From all sides, exactly. You know, sometimes it's funny. We actually have just begun tracking for the first time since I've been here, and I used to do this other places, but haven't done it here. We're going to start tracking, you know, sort of what our single copy sales spikes are versus what was on the front page that day. We have sort of only done it anecdotally, and our new circulation director, relatively new, and I agree that we want to do this. So we'll see. I mean, I haven't looked at it in looked at it methodically.
Well, we'll
in two
invite
or three
you
years.
Back when you've done a scientific study in two or 3 years. Anecdotally, I guess you don't have a strong feeling of what it would be that you would pray for in the way of tragedy or some great event that would lead Durham and Chapel Hill people to go out and buy an extra copy.
Yeah, you know, when somebody wins a national basketball championship, it's a wonderful celebration. It's great that that sells papers. But you actually touched on an important point. Tragedy is more often what drives newspaper sales than celebrations. And people talk about our tendency to focus on bad news, which I think is not altogether a fair caricature of newspapers. But the truth is that people often react more viscerally. And, well, I mean, you know, 9/11 was a huge newspaper sales event. And that was, you know, one of the greatest tragedies we've confronted as a nation in some time.
So you can be
People are sort of drawn. That's why people slow down for wrecks on the highway.
Yeah, of course. Well, you could be like the Outer Bankers who... Mm-hmm. It said during the time of storms would pray to the Lord to keep the ships passing by nearby out in the sea safe. But if in his will it should be decided that they should crash, could they crash close by so that we could get the salvage?
We could get the salvage, yes, exactly. That's sort of the way newspaper editors approach life, exactly.
I'm talking to Bob Ashley, editor of the Durham Herald Sun. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Bob Ashley. Bob is the editor of the Durham Herald Sun and oversees the publication of the daily newspaper in the Chapel Hill area, the Chapel Hill Herald. And Bob, as a part of that, mm-hmm. I mean, you're not only a the Chapel Hill is not right. only a circulation for the Herald Sun, right. but you also use this as a part of your paper. Mm-hmm. You've got a special Chapel Hill right. edition, so you watch Chapel Hill, and you're also I don't want to say you're new to Chapel Hill because mm-hmm. now you've been here longer than half the people here.
It's a tragic place, absolutely.
What do you know about Chapel Hill that we don't know, that you would share with
Boy,
us?
Well, I doubt I know anything, DG, that you don't. No. I've spent some time in Chapel Hill with you, and not only do you know everything mm-hmm. and everybody, but you have for mm-hmm. a long time. You know, Chapel Hill is a fascinating place, and it's struggling, as so many places are, with some of the predictable consequences of success in the early 21st century. I think the debate over Carolina North is symptomatic of that. I think it's absolutely a representation of the fact that what makes Chapel Hill Chapel Hill in large part is the presence of one of the greatest public universities in the country. And that university, with its ambitions, as shared by many great public and private research universities, is to grow its research capabilities, to expand, to continue to look for new ways to both to solve societal problems and interject them into the real world, which is part of, as I understand, Carolina North's mission, is to sort of bring research and technology and developments into interfacing with business and possibilities to have an impact. But at the same time, you've got folks who are very troubled by what that might mean for the dynamic of Chapel Hill. And when I knew Chapel Hill 35 plus years ago, as a Duke student who would come over here for dinner at the Zoom
room.
When
you wanted to get away
right,
and have a good time.
Exactly, and not be seen. I'd go to the Zoom room or the Rathskeller, which hasn't changed much in that time. But so much else of Chapel Hill has changed. The change has been dramatic. I was driving up to this to your station up here near Timberline from campus, the south side of campus, just now after lunch, and thinking, this has really become a much more sprawling place than I certainly remembered it as.
The Los Angelization of Chapel
right.
Hill.
Yeah, Los Angeles is a bit of an exaggeration, of course, but it's become profoundly larger. And I think a lot of folks both worry about what it's become and what it might become. And then there are other folks, go ahead.
Let me interrupt you because, and I ask you to think about what struck you as Chapel Hill. And you mentioned first Carolina North. And is that the biggest... Is that the biggest story ongoing that you see going on?
Well, I think in terms of not so much what's happening now, but in terms of the impact on the future of the community, I think that's a huge, over the next 30 years, if that develops as UNC envisions it will, that's going to have a huge impact on the community. But sure, there are lots of other issues. I mean, the whole question of downtown and Franklin Street. Again, our luncheon companion who talked about being worried about going to Franklin Street, I was over here just a couple of days ago for the Downtown Partnerships Public Safety Forum and Jack Spratz for an hour and a half on, I think it was Tuesday morning. And, there are people downtown that really wrestle with this. I mean, it's a sort of a moral dilemma. What do you do? Do you ban panhandlers? Well, there's a large segment of this community that says absolutely not. I mean, for free speech issues, for compassion issues. But then you've got folks saying, a parent comes here to bring their prospective student to Carolina, or they've come to visit for the first time for Parents Weekend, and their first encounter is with somebody who sells them a T-shirt, and their second encounter is somebody who holds out his hand and asks for 50 cents or bus fare to Smithfield or whatever panhandlers ask for these days. That's got to be a challenge. So I think, sort of trying to wrestle with its the impact of its downtown changing as the environs develop, what Carolina North means, what the growth of the university is going to mean, what its political culture is and evolves. It's a fascinating city for those reasons.
Well, let me suggest what I thought you were going to
say.
Okay. And see if you think I'm again. You haven't accepted any. You politely declined to accept all of my hypotheses every time. But you are in a business in the newspaper business that has been walloped by the new technology, right, and the alternate ways to deliver information. And you and all of your competitors and colleagues are struggling to adapt to that, mm-hmm, or to figure out a way to shift your businesses into that, right, if you can't survive otherwise. Now, at least to me, the same dynamics are in place for universities, which have had, mm-hmm, as newspapers did, a monopoly on the delivery of a certain kind of, mm-hmm, of educational experience, right, for the public, for good reason, and they did a great job, mm-hmm, just like newspapers did. But ultimately, isn't all that going to be swept aside by the alternate delivery methods? And aren't universities as blind to that as newspapers were 10 or 15 years ago?
That's an interesting point, D.G., that I'll confess I haven't thought much about. But it's
Well, that's a whole lot better,
right,
than just saying, no, you're wrong.
I suspect that, heck, what business or institution isn't being affected by the profound changes that computers, the Internet, modes of communication have wrought upon us? And again, we were talking at lunch about the fact that you see students walking across campus these days, side by side, chatting not with each other but with their friends, maybe 20 feet away, or maybe across the country, on their cell phones and listening maybe to the lecture they just missed on their iPod, but probably listening to Dire Straits. Well, no, they don't listen to Dire Straits anymore. Listening to whatever on their iPod. It's a profound change. And again, I was talking to some folks this morning involved with library science. And talk about an institution that's been profoundly changed by computers. Libraries are.
Yeah.
You no longer need 500 board feet of reference works.
I'm sorry to present a question. Right. I'm really proud to present a question to you that you hadn't thought of before. Ring the bell about that. But the universities, it seems to me, that situation, right, is different and more analogous to newspapers than any of the other, mm-hmm, businesses and enterprises which are personal lives that are impacted by this new, because of the exciting, mm-hmm, ways that information learning and interaction can be delivered, that universities have only a small piece, mm-hmm, of that, and they will continue certainly to have the small piece of it. But if things really change, what kind of impact would that have on Durham and Chapel Hill as the host of these great historic
and profound? It would be like the offshoring of textiles has had on Concord and Kannapolis. To carry that analogy out, it would be like what the decline of steel production had on Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania. You could draw one analogy after another. Detroit, I guess. While I find that really intriguing, somehow or another, it seems to me that the university experience, the sort of the knowledge acquisition, the knowledge sharing experience, may be impacted heavily by this, but maybe not in that kind of way. I'm not sure that. Although, again, I'll talk on both sides of the issue for a moment. Part of me says, the notion of intellectually curious people sitting around having a conversation about anything ranging from the national debt to the importance of the use of, of whether or not Neanderthals had the capacity to fight off the new European modern man coming into Europe 50,000 years ago. It seems to me it's going to take place in a sort of a human level interchange, despite all the technological developments.
Yeah, I agree.
On the other hand, on the other hand, we just talked about the fact that students walk across campus text messaging the people next in the classroom across from them. Will it make sense to my children, your grandchildren, who are probably about running close to the contemporaneous ages, to say, why do I need to go spend my day at a university when I can interact with people at 26 universities, right, at my computer in my bedroom or in my den?
I guess that's right. The economics of it might be easier for us to see, but if we're spending $30,000 a year for an, mm-hmm, experience that we can get essentially for free, if we're willing to take Western Civ from a professor in Bangalore,
right,
or whatever, that there will be people dropping away, that we've got the inertia and the, mm-hmm, history that says we've got to send our kids to universities, but as we price ourselves out of the market, as Duke already has for many people and Carolina threatens to do it every day, we find that people find alternate ways to get something equivalent to what we gave.
Sure, but isn't some of that the same thing as saying, well, you know, over time people have opted for correspondence courses or opted to take courses at, and I will not mention any particular college university here because it would be terrible, you know, the repercussions would be terrible, but fill in the name of some second or third level state-supported institution as opposed to paying the freight to go to UNC or to a Duke or to a Harvard or to a Yale or to a University of California or Stanford, fill in the name of a top university. People are willing to pay a large premium to do that when you might argue that if what you want to do is you know, get a job making more money as an accountant than you would as a grocery checker, you know, why would you could do that just as well if you went to community college U or whatever.
Right.
And so those are some of that premium. Well, people pay a premium for that level of intellectual discourse. Now, again, to be contradicting myself, one of the things that draws someone to a UNC or a Duke, particularly in the liberal arts, perhaps, is the rich library resources. The particularly at the higher levels, the ability to do extensive research in some of the great library collections in the world. Well, you know what? In five more years, every single inch of that is going to be digitized.
I know, and, Bob. We got to take a quick break, and then, but I want to come back. Next time you'll come back, and let's spend a whole hour talking about those issues. I'm talking to Bob Ashley, editor of the Durham Herald Sun. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Bob Ashley and I have been pontificating and postulating about
solving nothing, but talking about a lot.
That he knows about from personal experience and I only speculate about. But one thing that he sure knows more than any of the rest of us about, and that is the story of the purchase of the Durham Herald Sun and the, you know, the, what did you, the massacre at the
well,
at
that's, the not, initiation. That's not the term I use.
I know it, but I mean, it was the big story. And I watched this, and the community was in turmoil. I feel like I learned something about it. It looked like you all just bit the bullet and said, we're not going to make a big deal of this. We're not going to make a real big concerted effort to try to say we didn't do this because we did, and we're just going to try to, by the way we conduct our business, prove that it was beneficial not only for us but for the community. Now, has it been beneficial for y'all, and is it beneficial for the community? Is the new ownership willing to assert that?
Well, yeah, probably I'm the last person to answer the question about whether or not it's been beneficial to the community. The community has to answer that. But having given that caveat, I think we've done well by the community, and I think there's a lot of feedback that I get that indicates that. Are there still some people that are angry about it? Absolutely. On the other hand, as you know, E.T. Rollins, the last owner who sold it to Paxton Media Group, died last week. I had the occasion and the opportunity to attend the memorial service for E.T. and to visit with some of his family members and friends afterward. And I will tell you that I was gratified and felt really sort of a lot of warmth from some of them about accepting the fact that we came in to do what we felt like we had to do, but that we've really lived up to what I think was our commitment at the time, to be a part of this community, to cover these communities in a energetic and balanced and sometimes aggressive, sometimes celebratory way. And that's resonated with folks. I was having coffee with somebody the other day who talked, admittedly in my presence, but was very complimentary of the job that some of us, and included me in this, have done to cement the ties of the new leadership of the newspaper with the communities that we serve. And that's been very important to me, and I think we've not succeeded completely. I never succeed completely.
Well, no, of course. You could succeed completely, then somebody else could have done the job, and you wouldn't have gotten that high salary that you get. But now, the complex thing about running it is that you're in the shadow of the News and Observer, which is the state newspaper of record, and only 20 miles away.
Right.
And You all optimistically went in saying we can handle that. Do you still believe that's Secretary Rumsfeld and Cheney, as far as Iraq is concerned, that you weren't greeted with waiting?
I think
I've got to make all.
No,
these
that's
analogies.
Okay. I think we're winning the battle with the News and Observer. It's a good battle. It's a hard fought battle. The community is the better. The community benefits from having two newspapers.
Are y'all making money yet? Or are you?
Oh yeah, we're making money. Mm-hmm. We're making as much as as our owners wish we were. No, not quite. Right. And that's been as much as anything a factor of the fact that the bottom has fallen out of the newspaper advertising market everywhere, not just here. The News and Observer, from what I hear, and I don't want to speak of their case because I don't know firsthand.
The news is out, but I understand.
They're struggling. They had a story in their paper the other day, just a few weeks ago, that they've delayed plans for their long-awaited new building downtown, in part because of the softness of the advertising environment. So we're all dealing with it. We've got some challenges because of that, but I think we'll get through them.
Well, just as we get into the most interesting topic, our time runs out. Thanks, Bob Ashley, editor of the Durham Herald Sun, for joining us, and I hope you'll come back soon.
Thank you. Always glad to be back.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. I'll be back same time tomorrow.